Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestagelefpodcast.com for all episodes featuring drummers such as Wolfgang Fleur of Kraftwerk talking about the moment he accidentally created the world's first ever electronic drum set, Clive Deem of Radiohead and Portishead, Kieran Pepper of The Prodigy, Danny Goffey of Supergrass, as well as Tony Visconti recording David Bowie's final album Black Star, Steve Cropon writing Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, comedian Stuart Lee on how his creative process is derived from watching freestyle jazz artists, and Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses, plus many, many more. Today we're joined by Elbow drummer Alex Reeves, who is currently bathing in the aftermath of another Elbow number one record, who's just got back from playing the Late Late Show in the US, and we'll be discussing being taught by the legendary Bob Armstrong, some of the challenges of joining a band that's been around for 25 years, and how Guy Garvey's approach to his solo work differs from the Elbow records, playing with Bobby Womack on his final record, work with Dizzy Rascal, Uncle, Nick Cave, and if it's true, he played some Beatles songs with Paul McCartney. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Alex Reeves. Thanks for joining us today, Alex. How's it going?
Thank you, Stage Left. It's going very well. Thank you for inviting me onto this.
So we're sat in this beautiful studio, which is your own studio.
Is that
right?
It's beautiful.
It is very beautiful. We've got like records, framed records and instruments all around us in a fantastic studio. And to my right, is that your drum? Is the drum kit? Is that your drum kit that you've gone to?
The drum kit. Yeah. I mean, there's many drum kits, but this is the one that I chose would stick around in the studio and not come on tour with me. It's been sitting in my studio since I had a studio, actually, an old Ludwig super classic from it's a mixture, 70s, 60s, bits and bobs. And I've had it for such a long time. It was one of the first like vintage kits that I bought.
And is it set up exactly as you would do if you went on tour? Do you have to make any tweaks or anything like that for the actual, you know, the layout of it? Or is it exactly as is? Is it copied?
Do you know, that is an interesting question because each tour is different. Like, I suppose the snare height is the same and where I put my feet is the same, but apart from that, it's pretty much different for every single thing that I do. Though this is quite similar to the Elbow kit as a setup because it's got same size toms, same size snare, that kind of stuff. I've got more cymbals with that. I've got other snare drums with the Elbow, you know. And every time, so for instance, you know, you set up a kit for the gig. With Elbow, it's 20 years of music, and you know one snare drum is not going to be enough because everything sounds different, and one ride cymbal isn't going to be enough, and one set of hi hats isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, there's some experimental percussion, isn't there, and drums on Elbow records, which we'll get to in a little while actually. So you've just got back from playing the Late Late Show in the US.
Yeah,
all right. Tell us about that.
Well, we went over there to do a little tour. So we were kind of in California, Mexico City first. We did a beautiful gig out there in front of what I must say is one of the most delightful and enthusiastic audiences that I've been in front of, which I think is probably, you could probably say for a lot of kind of Spanish language kind of gigs, there's a kind of Latin passion that you don't get the reservedness. Everyone says what they feel in whether they're saying it to a person or whether they're saying it to a group of people playing on stage. It's pretty wonderful playing South America and places like that. And then we went up to California. Did some shows in San Diego, LA, San Francisco, and somewhere else. as someone once said, it's nice to be here wherever we are.
Yes.
get off the tour bus. Oh, this is nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then we did a radio show. We did KCRW Morning Becomes Eclectic, which is I've done a few times with different people now, and it's a pretty cool thing to do. They're really open to like pretty wild types of music. They really push like underground, not underground, but unusual artists, like, not the pop stuff. And you're asked to do a live session. I've done it with Bat for Lashes. I did it with Tom Veck. I did it with Anna Calvi as well, nice. Over in the US. And then just recently with Elbow. And we just did a live kind of more acoustic-y set on the radio shows. Really, really beautiful thing to do. And then we did the Late Late Show with James Corden presenting. And, you know, live in front of however many millions of people it is, kind of, it's pretty, you know, a little bit of pressure, but fun.
So how do you deal with that? So what's your approach to making sure you're in the zone, in flow for when that performance starts, when you know there's millions of people watching?
Yeah, don't think about it. you don't think, you know, you look at the people in front of you, you look at the audience, which is relatively small, a couple hundred people, and that's it. If you start thinking, if you start looking down from the tightrope, you realise quite how high up you are. Also, I think my approach to stuff like that is know what you're doing, you know, prepare. Preparation is really important. Like if you don't, for instance, you don't know the song, unless you're improvising, you don't know the song, you're kind of screwed from the moment that you start. But also, you don't know what you're wearing, you don't know what you look like, you don't know how to kind of, you know, how to look on television. If you need to act in any way, for instance, you know, in that particular song, I'm hitting the drums super hard, so I just hit them even harder, lifting my sticks higher up into the air because it looks good on the telly. Nice. You know, and that kind of promotional stuff that you do with a band is I hate to say it, but quite important, looking pretty good. Wear your nicest shirt, you know, that kind of stuff. That's how I prepare.
Yeah. And how does that differ from kind of some of the big gigs you've done in the past when you weren't quite as experienced as you are now? What else in the past did you used to do to get over those, I'm using nerves in inverted commas here, but that energy that's in part of you on a big gig day?
I played mind games with myself for a little while and they really worked. Because all nerves is a state of mind. It's just, you know, I know quite a few people who have that proper stage. It's not fright, that's probably the wrong word. It's maybe a bit extreme, but like very nervy before going on stage and deal with it. You know, if they make a mistake or if something goes wrong on stage, for instance, it will kind of ruin the gig for them a little bit.
Or catastrophize how big it feels.
Exactly, yeah. And then, you know, going on, instead of leaving that moment behind, that moment stays with them for the next moments. And it's a bit of a problem, like, because it's difficult to get over that stuff. So knowing that it was a mind game, I don't get nervous on stage at all anymore. And it's because when I started doing the Bat for Lashes gig in like whatever it was, 2013, my first gig was Coachella, like, God. And it was live on TV, and like that's the first thing, and it was the toughest thing I'd ever had to do in terms of my playing and the independence on the drum kit. The parts that I was playing were really tough. I was quite responsible as I was playing loads of electronics. This lovely little hybrid electronic drum kit, electronics and kind of a jazz kit that Chris Fatalero, the drummer, had kind of conceptualized and put together. And then he'd left. He wasn't able to do the next bit of the tour. So they were just like, who are we going to get? They found me. And I had to copy him kind of exactly. He was also singing, so I had to sing. And I was like, this is so hard, this is so difficult. So I just worked and worked and worked and worked, knew by the time, kind of, you know, planned it, knew by the time that I'd got to the actual gig that I was prepared enough to play it. I could physically play the gig, but you know those people who say that you've got to be 20 or 30% better in the practice room than you have to be on a gig, because there's all the other factors get in the way. There's the people in the audience. There's the sound is completely different. The feeling you have, most importantly, is completely different. All the outside influences are different to you sitting in your comfortable little practice room practicing on your V drum set or whatever it is. That stuff's easy because you're only against yourself. Whereas when there's lots of external factors, you've got to be able to ignore those. So what I did is I just said to myself, I'm not going to be nervous. And whenever there was a feeling of nerves, I was like, no, I can do this. This is great. Talked to myself. It was like coaching myself into not being nervous. That was it.
That's amazing. I was listening to a podcast at the weekend talking to a sports psychologist saying that one of the reasons for a lot of anxiety within sports people is that the practice that they have does not replicate the reality.
Yeah, right. Exactly right.
Is there any way that you can replicate the reality, or have you ever tried thinking about how that could be done?
Yeah, it's in your head. I mean, you literally can't replicate the reality because you don't know what the crowd is going to be doing and saying. You don't know what little bits of adversity you're going to have, like you're not getting a proper sound check because it's a festival, or like if you're playing electronics, the triggers are playing up on that particular day, or you know, the singer's in a bad mood and he's shouted at someone side stage or something, you know, what any of those kind of things can get in the way of your mind. So it's quite a tricky thing to do because you can't prepare for that. However, the feeling of playing and the volume you're playing at and physically how you're playing as a drummer,
yeah,
but it's probably more extreme with the physicality of it because you're using your whole body the whole time. Or when I started playing the Dizzy gig, I was playing, we were playing like arenas, we were playing in front of 20,000 people. And we were, one of the first things we did was Glastonbury on the Pyramid stage. It was like 90,000 people, whatever it was on that day. And so I practiced by sitting behind my kit, and I looked into the far distance and imagined and pretended. Mind games. It's just mind games. You know, so I taught myself into that bit of it and played in the way that I'd have to on those, on that kind of gig.
Visualization.
If I have, there's a story that a friend of mine told me about. He sat in with the We Will Rock You musical.
Yeah.
And he was like, so it was really, you know, the parts were relatively straightforward. Obviously, you know, playing Bohemian Rhapsody is one thing, and playing all those other songs, you got to be able to do it. And he goes, he sat for like a couple of weeks in his studio with his little V drums kit, with the bass player, some of it, and the bass player was like, "You're going to be fine, mate. It's no problem." He was reading it and all that kind of stuff, and then he got up and started doing the, sat behind the kit of the in the pit of this musical, a long established musical which had a drummer who would normally do it, who was the same every night, and you're allowed to change two things when you sit behind a kit like that. You're allowed to change the seat height. You're allowed to change the snare height. And he sat down and was like, "I cannot play this drum kit. There's a massive, the snare drum is like the only thing I can change. The hi-hats are 3 feet further to the left than I would normally play them. They're 16-inch hi-hats. Like, I've got these like tree trunk drumsticks, and the first tom is a 15-inch, 16-inch tom, and the first crash is what I'd normally use as a heavy ride cymbal. Oh. I cannot physically play this." And he did the first half of the show. And then was moved aside by the musical director and said that the old normal guy had come back to finish the show off.
Ouch.
Yeah, terrible, terrible. But so that's the stuff. That's the stuff. He could play the gig, and in his mind he could play the gig, but he physically, he couldn't, literally could barely lift the drumsticks. So we've touched upon electronic drums and that kind of thing a little bit so far. Do you think electronic drums in the future will replace kits? No idea. Who knows what the future is like? Saying will hybrid kind of, you know, robotic synthetic people replace people? Probably not, you know, but there'll be, you know, there'll be some kind of magical combination. I think they, you know, the same with the invention of the electric guitar and the invention of autotune and the invention of, like, you know, all those wonderful bits of technology, they're just used by creative people to make music. That's it. That's the only thing. And if you want, you know, drums fell out of favor for a decade in terms of live stuff, because it was a fashionable thing to make music that was played with a Linn drum or with, you know, or using loops or whatever. But it's a musical instrument. It will probably just adapt itself with the people towards the people who make the music.
Going back to kind of like habits on the day before gig, he talks about visualization. What do you do to warm up?
I usually just whack the sticks on something. If I can do it for 45 minutes, then perfect. But it also depends on the gig. Some gigs I'll need to, like, properly, you know, get involved and make sure that my hands and my feet are warmed up, my voice as well, like, because if I'm singing.
Yeah. What about tendonitis and stuff like that? Is there any risk?
Had any.
No.
But that's...
How would you avoid it? If you're a young drummer listening to this now, what are some of the things that...
Well, I don't know, because I'm no doctor. So I couldn't give advice on avoiding that stuff. But in terms of technique, I could tell you how to help yourself with that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think... I've seen drummers kind of blow their hands out and their wrists and fingers out by just... You know, hitting a drum is... You can... With good technique, you can do it. You can hit a drum pretty hard with quite little effort by using the stick and using your arm and everything, instead of just, if you're kind of gripping hard and you're tensing up, and you've got tension in your back and in your arms and in your hands, and you think the drums sound really loud. They probably do. They probably sound, you're probably really whacking them and, you know, making a big sound. But like down the road, give it 10 years of playing live shows like that every day, you might well mess your hands up. You might well end up wearing gloves or, like, you know, there's a few kind of well-known drummers who've kind of blown their hands out and can't really play anymore. So, yeah.
Is it something you think about a lot or?
No, I never really had to. I used to play pretty quietly. Well, I started out playing super loud and then I got quiet. And then I got loud again. It just depends on the gig. Like with Elbow, I started out playing quiet, well, relatively quietly. And everyone was like, you know, just turn everything up. But actually, you play in a stadium, we've played one stadium, but playing arenas and stuff like that, the nuance is lost and hitting hard kind of suits it. And actually, it's really fun. And, it, you know, I'm a skinny guy. I'm no like, you know, bulky big hitter kind of thing. I haven't got the muscularity for that, but I kind of, you know, when you're doing a tour of like big places, I feel the pleasure of feeling your muscularity change as a result of doing a 2-hour gig really loud is like, it's pretty great.
And what do you need to be in place sound wise that you are okay, I'm ready for this gig and I'm really happy in your monitors? What is it that you need?
Well, it all
starts for an elbow gig.
Well, it all starts way before the in-ears. I mean, like we've got a wonderful front of house engineer and general engineer and producer in the studio called Danny Evans with Elbow. He's been working with Elbow for, I don't know, I think the longest time, yeah. And he's, you know, he's a very skilled person. He's got incredible ears, but he produces the live show as much as just kind of, you know, turns, you know, EQs and turns things up and down. I know that's not, you know, that I don't mean to belittle what a live sound engineer will do. It's a pretty tricky job with a lot of nuance and skill needed, but he gets involved right from the beginning. So the recording, you know, so he knows the record, he knows the band, he knows how things want to sound and how he wants things to sound. He'll like, you start playing in the rehearsal, you'll finish that little run through of the song, and then Danny Evans will come out from behind his desk and he'll start walking over, and everyone will look at each other being like, who's it going to be? And it would go up to, at first it was me all the time when I first joined, and he was like,
oh, no.
Alex, would you mind playing the floor tom a little bit quieter, and also it's a bit of a ring on there, and the snare drum is like this tuning and it's not quite right, and you're hitting the cymbal too loud, and essentially what he was doing was adjusting the sound at source. And it met everyone who comes to these gigs is like, it sounds so good.
Wow. Nice.
You know, so you slightly, you know, need to adjust. You don't change your personality. You just slightly adjust what you're doing to suit the sound of the band. You know, you can see him kind of going to pot the guitar player and saying, that sound is too trebly. Can we change this? And there's a bit too much like of this kind of effect on that song. Let's change that.
And he's got the freedom to do that. And
everyone respects that he can do his job better than, like, you can do his job, and wow. You know, he'll just get involved. So it's the same kind of, you get it with pretty much everything. You get it with an MD, you know, producing a pop band. You know, they're kind of, a lot of their stuff is in the box to start with. They'll be sitting on Ableton or whatever they're using, and sounds will be triggered from a laptop or whatever they're triggering, you know, a drum brain or whatever they're sampling into. And those sounds, if that sounds too loud, this is too much, that instrument is not right in this song, if you've got another instrument, that kind of stuff. So he does the same job as, you know, that, but he's just happens to be the front of house guy. So it's interesting. There's quite a few people who do that kind of thing, crafting the sound from the beginning.
So why drums in the first place for you?
Don't know. Why? I don't know. Why is an interesting question, isn't it? Why drums? Took to it. I liked it. I never played anything else, really. I can't really play any other instruments to any high degree. I tried some other stuff, and it was, for me, all about whacking things.
Why is that?
Well, okay. Physicality, I think, and personality, I do think, lead you to a certain kind of instrument. And I've got a 4-year-old son, and I can see why I play the drums through the kind of like love of movement and running and stuff like that. And you probably say that about a lot of 4-year-old kids, boys or girls, whatever. And but that carried on with me in the same way that some other kids might be more static and like to sit and craft things. Some other children might want to, you know, like interact in a certain way with the world. My son wants to do stuff, and he wants to make noise, and he wants to be physical and use his physicality. And I always thought when I was a kid, in terms of a job anyway, I was like, there's nothing for me. I don't like any of the things that I got taught at school. I didn't like maths. I didn't like geography. I know there was some things about those things that I liked, but, and then my best friend who lived next door to me since I was a kid was like, why don't you try? So I did. And
how old are you at this stage?
I was 15.
Right, that's late.
Yeah, really late. I mean, there was, when I was a little boy, when I was in my kind of village growing up, there was a drummer who came into school and like played, and I was like, that, I want that. This is all I've ever wanted. And then he got me, I put my hand up the highest. I was about 6 or 7 or something. And he got me up and I played some of the drums. And it was like clearly there, like I could clearly just play in time and play a beat. I loved it then. And then I never ended up picking it up, despite my teachers at the time going to my parents and saying, this boy should play the drums. So I don't know, it was in me to a certain extent.
And then when did it, so for context, when I went to school in somewhere called Hornchurch in Essex, and it's a very kind of uneventful place, I would say.
My drum teacher was
there. We go. This is where I'm coming to.
Yeah,
So we were in school. I was probably 13 years old, and there was this person in my class called Laura, and she always used to say that she was having like really, really well-known musicians come around to her house, and we all thought that she was like just bullshitting.
Tell me a second name.
And and then she was like, oh, my dad's like a bit of a legendary drum tutor. Was like, yeah. And she was saying, oh, I got this person coming over. This, it's like, of course, it's Laura Armstrong.
Yeah, amazing.
Bob Armstrong. I spoke to her yesterday.
Did you really?
Yeah, because I said that I was interviewing you. And I said that we're going to do a bit of a tribute to Bob if you're happy to. So obviously, unfortunately, passed away last year.
Any time to do a tribute to the great man.
So tell us about Bob, how you got involved with him. And specifically, what is it about you? What is it that you do in your drumming right now that you learnt specifically from him? Or he gave you?
He doesn't give you anything. He kind of opens a door, and do you know what? That's not true. He does give stuff to you, and it's technique to start with. Like it's so much more. It's everything, you know. And everything leads to, everything points towards music. Whatever I did with Bob, it was like, here's how you apply it. It was never, this is how you play the fastest, or this is how you play, this is how you express a paradiddle on the drum kit. It was never just that. It was always, and here's how you can apply it to music. Always wonderful way of teaching. The place we started was adjusting my hands and feet and making sure that what I was doing was played with the stuff we were talking about earlier on, you know, with a relaxed hand and with technique that could help me and wouldn't hinder me in any way. He taught something called the molar technique, which I know is a kind of long classic drum technique. Was a Canadian guy? Was he Stanford Molar? I can't actually remember his first. Okay. It's been a while since I thought about this. He was taking his lead from like military drummers and which Bob kind of also ended up teaching a lot of the kind of military guys.
Right.
And the kind of side drum stuff, the military marching kind of music where everyone was playing traditional grip because the side drums, you know, kind of a diagonal thing to your left hand side. You with your left stick, you're holding it. You're holding it traditional grip. Right hand is you're holding it, you know, straight through the hand. Anyway, for the first, like the first, probably, God, 6 months, I was playing jazz ride, one hand on the ride cymbal at 60 beats per minute, to a 12 bar jazz like jazz bass line, the click one. Two, three, four. Dun, 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 dun. I could sing you every note in that.
Wow.
I played it so much, 60 beats per minute, with a specific technique, with a molar technique. So down on that, down on the beat, and then up on the lope, up on the one triplet, two triplet, three triplet. So up on the let. Mm-hmm. Then add the left foot, and the left foot was like, yeah, fine, no problem on the two and the four. Dun, dun, dun. No, you're doing it wrong. No, this is this. No, you need to be going down and chop and down and chop. So then you've got right hand, 6 months of like, you know, wow, this technique. And it's, look at it. I mean, Ding, da, ding. My elbow's going up, my wrist is dropping, I've got my hand, you know, all this stuff is literally taking my playing apart. Then you add the right foot. No, you need to feather it. You need to play it quieter. No, you need to do this. Now your right hand's gone. Now your left foot's gone. All this kind of stuff. Another 3 months of that.
Wow.
Like, you know, and up to 70 beats per minute, up to 90 beats per minute. Okay, at 90 beats per minute, you're losing it. Let's go back down to 70 beats per minute. Let's add the left hand. You know, and you're just like, I've been in months. I haven't even used my left hand yet. Remarkable experience. And like, you know, it's like something you were saying earlier on actually caught my ear. You're talking about the sports, the sports star and the kind of mind game of that kind of stuff. There's this book called The Inner Game of Music.
Yes, great.
Which was written
for Inner Game of Tennis originally.
Exactly. Yeah. So the inspiration. The guy read Inner Game of Tennis and was just like, all I need to do is replace the word tennis with music, and I've got like an entire book because it's all mind games, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, the concentration that I had to kind of level. The level of concentration I had to use with Bob just in his lessons, like we would be there for an hour doing the same thing, and it's like meditation. You're concentrating really hard for that hour. And he goes out, you know, okay, I'll be back in a minute. Goes out for a cigarette, comes back 5 minutes later, expects you to not have changed in any way, like at all. And if you have, or if you've messed around, he's listening. He can hear you.
Yeah.
You know, he'll come in and be like, I heard that. Now, if you can't play for 5 minutes with that kind of level of concentration, then you need to work on that.
Wow.
And I went to him for 9 years. So it was 9 years of that.
9 years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the end, it was like it was a bit more sporadic because I was I think I just got the Dizzy gig at that point. So it was 2000. That was 2008. So like the last bits were like it was a bit more ad hoc.
And how was he supporting different styles that evolved that weren't traditional to the music that he had been playing or listening to growing up and assisting you into being enabled to play that type of music?
Well, I suppose the assistance comes from the fact that if you've got a bit of technique and if you're able to concentrate, you can apply it to anything. You know, I know a lot of the players who've come from Bob and they're all different. They might all have a technique and they might all, you know, like to a certain extent look similar while they're playing, but everyone's expressing it in a different way. So Steve White, for instance, like, you know, what a badass. He's like, you know, he's played on these amazing records with this amazing sound, but it's a specific, not a specific thing he does, but he's got, you know, he sounds like him. He doesn't sound like Bob Armstrong. He doesn't sound like someone else. He sounds like Steve White because he's able to express the personality of Steve White. Andy Gangadin is the same thing. Like, look at those two drummers. Taught by the same guy, polar opposite types types of music that they express themselves with, but they're able to do it because they've got the thing. They were helped so much by Bob. Obviously, not everyone who goes to a great teacher is going to be a great player, but the teacher kind of sees what that person's got and encourages it and gives the tools and kind of sends them on their way to do their thing. So it's a really interesting, you know, getting a great teacher is, I think, it's better than YouTube for that. But you, though, you're not dissing that at all.
Yeah,
that's a great way of learning, you know, a brilliant way. But you know, when you've got someone literally standing over your back saying, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, that bar was good. You know what I mean? Like, that one was good. That bar, oh, that feels nice. Oh, it's gone. You know, that staying in the moment, keeping you know, your technique kind of serving your personality or your, you know, whatever you want to express or whatever the people you're playing with want you to express.
And when you started playing these bigger gigs that were high profile gigs and your profile started rising, how did like the music industry at that level differ from your expectations growing up wanting to be a musician playing big gigs? What's like the thing that's the myth really in comparison to the reality?
Do you know, I don't know because that's my expectations of what music was when I was a kid, and all I wanted to do was play. I didn't really care about anything else. I just wanted to play music. So in terms of differing from my original kind of dream, they didn't really. It was like my first kind of like touring stuff was with a singer songwriter called Ezio, and I was touring. I was 19, 20, whatever it was, 21 maybe, and I toured with him for like 8 or 9 years, like on and off all the time. Acoustic guitar, two acoustic guitars, bass, drums. Acoustic guitars played like kind of rock and roll kind of thing, but still quieter than an electric. Not really amplified. Everyone's, you know, I was set up side of stage, playing these wonderful gigs with these amazing songs. But then, like, witnessing what rock and roll on a relatively small level, you know, playing in front of 800, 1,000 people in certain countries, but playing in front of 200 people in different places. Seeing that kind of, you know, the lifestyle around it was fun. It was like, this is, it's not just about playing music, is it? It's about hanging out, and it's about making friends, and it's about partying and drinking at that time. Good Lord. Like, you know, that kind of stuff. So didn't really differ at all.
Great. That's
good to hear. Question.
That's great. So let's talk about a couple of specific recordings that you've done that I checked out. So you played on Bobby Womack's last record, right?
I did, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's some great tunes on that record.
Yeah, some really good ones.
So what? Tell us about the process, how you got involved with that.
Well, it's interesting because it was like so much of my work, it's come from mates, it's come from friends. And one of my oldest friends from music, certainly, is a guy called Hal Ritson, who is who runs this company called Replay Heaven. And he was doing stuff for, well, loads of artists. He got me on the Dizzy gig, you know. And he's what he does, he kind of, to make a living, part artistic, but to make a living, he found a little kind of legal gap in the music world, which is exploits the fact that you have to pay a lot if you want to use a sample of music in your music, so of someone else's. So for instance, if someone wants to use the James Brown Funky Drummer Loop, they have to pay two things. They have to pay publishing, the writing of the song, mm-hmm. to the James Brown estate, and they'd have to pay for the master fees of to the, you know, the person who owns the master, which is usually the record company. Mm-hmm. People can charge what they want, and especially for the master, they're expensive. So he was just like, I'll recreate it so it sounds exactly the same. So you pay the publishing, but you pay us less than the master fee. So I did loads of records for him where I was replaying a song. Replaying is a polite word of basically copying it. And you know. Anyway, he's like one of the biggest guys for this. He's like the go-to biggest company around, proper quality, properly good at it. But we'll also, he's like, oh, but also we could do an alternative version if you want. If you want to, you know, we'll get this sound, but we could play something different. So maybe you don't have to pay the publishing, and, you know, it's a funky band that we've got in, or it's a drum thing that we've got in. So I'll talk about the Bobby Womack thing, but that's how I ended up doing that Uncle Nick Cave track. You know, I was
a tune. I listened to it over the weekend.
It's amazing. It's so good. But it was a replay of another song, which if you listen to it, you might get, actually. Oh, I'm not going to say, okay, in case there's a legal thing going on. I don't think there is. I don't think there's a legal. But I played it. I got the sound, and I played it like I was supposed to, like the original, like I was supposed to, and the sample that they'd used and taken.
Where was it? In here? Or
I recorded it. Yeah, kind of. I recorded it in my old studio at the in Old Street in the Fortress when I was there years ago. And then I was like, should we do some other stuff? Should we try some different fills and different kind of like feels, different types of beat? And they were like, yeah. And they used that take. Like, it was like, played a wet pay one. They were like, yeah, send it to the guy. They weren't with me. I was sending it to them. Yeah, yeah, okay. And I sent them another one, and they just used that whole take as it was.
So what they sent you? They sent you like a guide or like...
Send me separate stuff. So generally people will send me like the drum track, the track and vocals separately. And then I can mute the drums, play along with the music with a click, turn the vocals up and down, whatever you need. Because obviously you need to know... If your fill is crashing a vocal line.
And then Bobby Womack, was that a similar kind of process?
Exactly the same kind of thing, yeah. It was like...
What were you sent for that? Similar kind of thing?
Just exactly. Well, it was like, here's what we want to replace. Because it was Damon Albarn producing it. It was like, here's what we wanted to do.
Right.
Here's what we want to kind of like get, you know, get. And I was like, yeah, great, do that. And here's some alternatives if you want. And they almost inevitably use the alternatives because it's the same vibe. It's the same thing, you know. What's you got to, when you play music, you got to search out for what's the thing that people love and what are they after. And that might not be a kind of like semantic question so much as a feeling that you get from it, and you just feel that, and you just kind of, you know, push yourself in that direction, and do some alternatives on that. And they always use that stuff. That's the stuff, because that's the personal. That's why, in fact, going back to your question about machines replacing people in. To a certain extent, that's why that'll be very difficult to do, because the magic happens in the imagination and the, you know, in the feeling that you get. It's all emotion.
And I mean, obviously quite a massive thing that you played on that last record. Were you happy with the outcome? Do you ever listen back to stuff and go, oh, actually, that isn't kind of what I intended from what I was doing?
Oh, yeah, all the time. but I mean, not that record.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. There's a couple of very weird beats on that one.
Yeah.
Is it the Lana Del Rey one? I can't remember. It's been a while since I listened to that.
Yeah, she definitely performs on one of the songs.
Yeah, but yeah, I can't remember what beat it was. There was a beat that was really like, it sounded like a cart with a wonky wheel on it. It sounded like something was broken, and they looped that, and it was like weird. But I get it. Like, I totally
gave it an edge.
Totally understand. You know, it's that you're just serving. You're the craftsman in this particular instance. You put a certain amount of art in it, and a certain amount of emotion and love. But you are the craftsman at the end of the day. You're doing what you've been asked.
On that then, so for a lot of kind of stage left musicians or session musicians, what about your creative outlet? Does that still tap into your creative outlet, or do you sometimes feel that you need to get that out in a different way if you're just kind of playing what someone else is asking you to play?
I've got to ask myself, do I have a creative outlet of my very own? And I suppose that's over the years, the decades now, my good Lord, like, I'm getting on. Over the decades, you learn to serve because I'm a sideman. I do have original thought, and I do have the kind of original like ideas and stuff, but on their own as drums, I need other people. I need harmony and melody and poetry over the top of stuff, really, to kind of make my heart sing. Otherwise, just drums, they're great and they're fun and I love them, and I will make a drum track, but I wouldn't listen to just a drum track on its own. So I have to serve at somebody else's pleasure to a certain extent. So my creativity kind of comes in, you know. Yeah, I'm creative all the time. I am always being creative, but within boundaries and within a remit and within somebody else's, like, you know, brief.
Which brings me on to my next question, which was, talk us through some of the challenges, maybe if another musician is in this situation in future, which is a very unique situation where you joined Elbow after kind of they've been going for 25 years,
right.
They're a very established drummer for many years, he left and you stepped in. What you've described is probably the perfect personality for what they were asking for at that stage, I would say, but maybe not. But talk us through some of the challenges of that. Must be a weird experience to step
totally
into that brotherhood. And how did you tell us about those first couple of rehearsals and
yeah,
how that
right.
dynamic worked?
Oh my God. That was, I mean, you know, again, going back to the preparation thing, like I really prepared for that. I'd been listening to it. I mean, I've been listening to Elbow for ages anyway. I was a fan already, which is great when you can be in that situation. But more importantly, it's a band that it was 20 years going, you know, that band, they're on their eighth album now. Like, it was pretty, it was a pretty big ask, because you're not just playing drums. You're pretending to be someone else in on the drum stool, you know, maybe not in the pub, but in the drum stool. And you don't want to, In fact, I asked Guy about this when we first started doing it. And I was like, you got any advice? You know, what do you think? And he said, be yourself on the new stuff and be Jup on the old stuff. And then eventually, if it keeps going and if it works out, it'll be all you. And I was like, you're absolutely right. Because I had to learn something. You know, I was stepping into big shoes. He's a great drummer and he's a really creative player, really interesting. You know, he's a writer, he's co-written all those tunes in the music by Elbow, lyrics by Guy. You know, they're all that, the whole mm-hmm. output, the whole canon. So kind of stepping into that, it's like, you know, what do you do? So I got sent all the stems of live stuff, got the drums on their own, got the verses, the music on its own, got the singing on its own, and then could piece it all together. So essentially for a little while, for, I don't know, a few weeks, I was able just to play along with Elbow without the drums, without the original drums in there, and get it. And then when you go into the first rehearsal, you've got the parts down, but suddenly there's all the personalities in the room. You know, we were talking about earlier on, like, you know, suddenly it's like you're playing for a slightly different drum kit. You've chosen each, you've got to tune everything a certain way. Like, I had to tune my snare drum super low, be, you know, meaty and doofy. And had to play in a different place on the beat to where I was probably, had to play right back. on some of it anyway. It was pretty tough. That's not a very concise answer, I'm afraid, because it's not a really concise thing.
Well, what it seems from, you know, thinking about that and what you've just said is that was such great clarity that Guy gave you when he said, right, okay, old stuff Jupp, new stuff you. Probably exactly what you needed to hear time. So you know, okay, now I know what you want from me. What about kind of settling in personality wise with that brotherhood of 25 years? I mean, you knew Guy already because you played on his previous record.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that was the kind of audition for me as well. Right. I'm not saying that Guy's solo record was an audition. Yeah. It was a brilliant thing in its own right. But what he could then vouch for me. He was like, we should get this guy in because I think he'd be really good. And he knew that I could tour with musicians and not fall out with people, and that there's so much about, you play for 2 hours a night, there's 22 other hours to kind of, you know, that you're and touring is, it's a microcosm, it's like the Big Brother house, you know.
Have you had a situation where they think something and you think something else?
Of course.
And you have, but then you've gone, actually, should we do it this way? Are you at that level of like trust with them yet that you could challenge their ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a paid by the day session musician at the end of the day. Yeah. So I'm not supposed to be stepping on anybody's toes, and I'm not throwing any hissy fits. You know, I'm a professional. I put on, you know, I do what I'm told. But as a session musician, you know, talking about creativity, this is probably a way of answering that previous question, actually. You bring something to it. There are great parts in the history of music that have been brought up by a session musician. How about this? How about that? That have defined a sound. Listen to 50 Ways to Live Your Lover, you know, like, what a part. Like, who comes up with stuff like that? Paul Simon wrote the song around that, you know, that kind of like slightly military style kind of beat that Steve Gadd had done. So, you know, you bring something to the game. If you're just doing as you're told, you're going to kind of, I don't know, you definitely have to do what you're told. You know, advice to everyone out there, if there's a hierarchy, follow the hierarchy. If the tour manager tells you to turn up on time, turn up on time. If the, you know, if the MD of the band says, you're playing this too loud, play quieter, you know. There's those kind of things. But if you find that the situation allows it, offer your opinion. If you know, you're to give people the option. What do you think, Al? Like, what do you think, Reevesy? Like, I think it could be like this. How about this? I've got another idea. How about that? And more often than not, like I said earlier on, they'll go with that because it's another person, another feeling in the room. People want you. People want the person. They don't want a machine to just play the parts. People want the people.
That's an amazing answer.
Well, I'm also thinking, I mean, it's such a big thing, like going to the kind of coming into the studio, for instance. Like, if I'm recording for somebody and they're here, then it's a conversation, and it's like, it's a, you know, you come to an agreement about what the right part and sound and feel is for that song. Whereas if you're doing a remote session, which is obviously one of the stock ways that a lot of people work, I do as well, then you're second guessing everything, and you're kind of like in your own head, you know, is this the right part? I don't know. You know, you're obeying the music, but someone really has to trust you to play remotely. Someone has to know exactly what they want and tell you exactly what they want to play remotely.
And did you play on all of the Guy Garvey solo records?
Yeah.
Right, so there's like one tune on there. It's like proper Afrobeat.
Is
it Open the Door? I think
Open the Door.
Yeah,
it's killer,
wow,
isn't it?
That's such a good tune.
Do you know what? That was the natural conclusion of that album. That was where we were all trying to get to and didn't realise it to start with.
Yeah, some great stuff on that record. So how did... So you've played on one Elbow record now and you played on Guy Garvey's.
I played on Little Fictions
as well, of course, right.
And the new one. And Giants of All Sizes.
So how did Guy Garvey's approach... Like, how did those two... experiences differ? So the Elbow records from the Guy Garvey, having seen kind of from both lenses?
I suppose the solo... Well, obviously the first thing I did was the solo record. And if I was to look back and describe it, I'd call it Guy Garvey off the leash. And I don't mean that he's kind of held back or anything. What I mean is he's like, you know, he's... There's with Elbow and with any band, up until that moment, it had been a five-way decision on everything, you know. And I think that's one of the strengths of a band, is everyone's opinion matters. Everyone's like musical input is really fundamental and really important. Everyone has a voice, but it's the whole, you know, it's essentially a democracy. Whereas with Guy's record, he said to me at the beginning, he was like, I'm nervous. And we, you know, we didn't really know each other at this point. The first time I met him was in the first day in the studio in Real World. And it was like, hi. I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what he wanted. I just filled the car full of stuff. And he was like, I'm really nervous about, or maybe he talked about it later on after a few wines. But he was like, I've not played with another band before. I was like, wow, that's a really big thing to say, because obviously, you know, I'd been doing it for 20 years, like playing with different people every day. Like, look at my diary, it's different people every day. Like, it's mad. So you kind of take it all on, and you he's such a creative force, and he's one of the most talented musicians I've ever worked with. Not that there's a hierarchy or a top 10, but he's a remarkable person and musician. They all are in Elbow. They're properly good. Properly amazing and really, really good at their instruments and really good in their minds and like how they actually create and how they kind of write together is something to behold. It's pretty, it's beautiful.
And how did that differ then from when you did Little Fictions in the most recent album to Courting the Squall?
Courting the Squall,
yeah. How did that, so obviously a different band, how did it differ in regards to the creativity?
Well, guys play, oh, it's very interesting, but Guy was essentially playing all the instruments on the album. Listen to Courting the Squall and it's like that, every instrument, you could put like Stevie Wonder, every instrument played by Stevie Wonder, apart from he couldn't play the drums to the, he can actually play the drums, but he couldn't play the drums to the level he wanted. He couldn't play the bass to the level he wanted. He couldn't play the guitar to the level he wanted.
So he guided everyone kind of.
So he'd be like, play this. And the first song that I did, man, I mean, I had a set of headphones on. We'd set up a drum kit. I'd set up a second drum kit because the first drum kit I set up was like completely the opposite of what I thought it was, of what it ended up being. I was going in for a like break, singer-songwriter breakup album with all my rustic old like calfskin drums. And he was like, I want it to sound like Fela Kuti and Astral Weeks. And I was like, whoa, I'll just pop into the other room for a minute, guy. Give us a minute. Changed all the drum kit, you know, made it into a bit more of a jazz thing or like a bit more punchy and driving. the first thing we did was... Oh, do you know what? I can't remember which one it was. Wasn't this house, that house. It was another one anyway. But it was such an interesting beat. And he hadn't written the song. And he hadn't written the music. And he was standing on the other side of the studio with a microphone and a set of headphones on going, okay, can you, while I was playing to a click, going, can you go to that cymbal now? Okay, go half time. Try half time. Yeah, stay there. That's nice. Yeah, hit that cymbal again. That's nice cymbal. So this is what I'm getting in my ears. This... Like a click and him. Yeah, yeah. Can you just try Tom thing? Well, that's good, yeah. Can we do that again? Okay, go back to that first beat, you know, that. And that's the song. And that's the take that we used. Me going, I have no idea what's coming up. Okay, can you do an ending? Not that. Okay, just hold that symbol. Can you do a different ending? Click still going. And then the song came around that. And then there's a part, bass was written to that, guitar was written to that. And then the vocals, everything just builds on top of each other. He was playing the room, you know, like... It was remarkable.
Orchestrating it, really, yeah.
Orchestrating
yeah.
everything. Nice. So the difference, going back to your original question, the difference with Elbow is, you know, the instruments go to him. So there's a part and, you know, the music is not always, but the music kind of, here's what the band has written, let's write some, guys write some lyrics on the top of that. Or, you know, guys like, I've got an idea here, and then someone else comes up with something completely different that no one would have expected. So it's a remarkably different way. But I can see that he's, you know, you can hear his voice in everything, literally his voice, and also his kind of creative, metaphorically speaking, his creative voice as well in the lot. They're all geniuses and they're all brilliant.
They certainly are. Yeah, thank you for answering that. So honestly, it's so interesting to see how they went about that process. Now, a bit of a weird question I'm going to give you now, and there's a reason I'm going to give you this question. I've always had this debate with my friends in the pub. If we found out the world was going to end tomorrow, and I saw anything at the world, what would, if you could find 5 minutes, obviously you spend your time with your family and your friends and do what you need to do. But if you find 5 minutes to listen to a song, what would it be? And the reason I'm asking it is my one is My Sad Captains by Elbow.
Is it really?
It really is, yeah.
Oh, God. Well, if you're with your mates in the pub, that's the song to listen to.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if it's like 5 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the sun's coming up.
And all that, yeah.
Yeah.
Mine is My Sad. That's why I thought I'd bring up this question too.
That's beautiful. And, right, I'll pass that on as well.
Oh, right, lovely. Yeah. So what would yours be? I mean, that's a difficult question. I
have no idea. I mean, people, you know, what's your favourite music? How do you answer that? I just don't know. It would be something beautiful. It would be something beautiful, but I couldn't tell you what. I mean, if I had 24 hours to think about it, right at the very last, I'd probably have thought, this is probably the good thing. Maybe me and my wife and my son had put a soundtrack on while we drove up to say goodbye to the parents-in-law, you know. My parents-in-law, her family.
Yeah. It's a deep question, I know, but I just wonder if there was anything that really came to mind that you thought, oh, it'd have to be this piece of music.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I really couldn't tell you. There's such beautiful music in the world, and to choose one is, like, I tried to think of my Desert Island Discs, and it was just like, can't do it. Can't
10 years later, you're still deciding.
Well, it's also like the morning is different to the afternoon, isn't it? And then, you know, the kind of, you know, when you're listening at a gig, then you want all of those songs. But when you go home, it's none of them. You know, and often, to be honest, people say, "So what are you listening to at the moment?" It's like what I need to learn, or what the next tour is, or, like, you know, often it's something that I have to be part of.
Wow,
there's an interesting thing I heard the other day actually about the kind of parts of your brain that become engaged when you're involved in music. And when you're listening to music, it was a guitar player friend of mine talking about it, and he was brought in to do this kind of psychological experiment, and they put him in an MRI machine and played music to him, and he's a guitar player, and apparently the stuff when he was listening to stuff, his emotional reaction was much stronger if it was something that didn't have guitars in, or that he hadn't already got involved in playing.
Right.
And the reason behind that apparently is because there's one side of your brain that says, I want to be able to involved in that, and I could do it, and I want to get, and that's the analytical side.
Yeah.
And then there's this other bit, which is like the kind of just the feelings. And of course those two things, you know, the right hand side, the left hand side, whatever, well, yeah, it's probably not as simple as that. But they're the things that that kind of drive you, and that you end up trying to not think about. You know, you want to be guided by your feelings when you play. Well, maybe not always, but a lot guided by your feelings when you play music. So, in answer to your question, don't know. Sorry.
There's two Beatles things I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
So the first one is, I cannot even begin to imagine how tempting it must have been when you recorded Golden Slumbers, right?
Yeah.
Right, at the end, when he sings, and I'll sing that lullaby, and it fades out, how you couldn't go boodum, 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 straight to carry
it
that way.
No, I couldn't resist it. And when we were recording drums on it, that happened.
Did it? Right?
But more times than I'd like to admit.
But yes, you
you got it. Just kept. And it was like, how? And they were like, how are we going to end this? Because the Beatles didn't bother ending it. They just slammed another song onto it. Like, what do you do? So they just did another bit and ended it.
Yeah. But the thing I'd really like to talk to you about is that you were playing a gig, kind of a covers thing, I think, playing some Beatles songs. McCartney was in the audience.
Yeah, right.
And got up and played with you.
He did.
And you played Beatles songs with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, that was pretty.
That is a peak. That is, I don't know if it gets better than that.
Do you know what? I was on a high for days. I was on a high for days and days after that.
Is that all?
Yeah. Well, then I told everyone about it and didn't stop for a little while. I put it on my CV for a little bit. And then I was like, yeah, probably shouldn't be. I didn't really play. I don't really play for Paul McCartney.
No.
But there was, yeah, he got up. And he was like, do you mind if I play with you guys? And we were like, who's this guy?
Do you know the songs?
but then he goes, and we were like, what would you like to play? And he said the following words, do you know any Beatles songs?
Oh, bless him.
And we were like, yes, we do. What would you like? And we just started playing Beatles songs. And not old, like the rock and roll stuff.
So can you remember what exactly you played?
Saw Us Standing There. We played some rock and roll stuff as well. God, what was it? It was such a long time ago.
All My Loving, maybe. That was one of their early.
Yeah, I might have played that. God, do you know, that's terrible. I can't remember now.
No,
is it?
But
amazing, an amazing experience. And he was just singing.
Was he playing bass as well?
No, the bass player was on that gig. Was a right-hand. Chris Hill, his name is. What a musician, Chris Hill. Wow.
Right.
Props to you, Chris. He was playing bass and he's right-handed. So he just sang. And he just sang, and he just sounded like I was in the Beatles all of a sudden. And the it was funny because the joy on stage was palpable. And you looked over and the joy in the room was remarkable. Oh, we're watching a Paul McCartney gig, playing Paul McCartney songs, like proper. And then I remember driving home and I just spent the whole journey legally phoning people. With my hands free, kids, yeah, make sure you follow the law. and I phoned, the first person I phoned was someone who is now my wife, Lottie Mullen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Because we
That's
were...
That's your wife?
Lottie Mullen, yeah.
So oh, you on had your no playlist, idea. Right, yeah. I literally was listening to a song called, was it My Valentine's Song or something like that, right, on your playlist.
Yeah.
And I dragged that across to my playlist for this year
because
I
love it.
And I was going to ask you about that. It's Lottie Mullen.
We're married, yeah.
And that's your wife?
Yeah, yeah.
Had no idea. Right,
so
okay,
so I phoned her first. We weren't together at the time, but we'd become like super good friends over over 2 or 3 months. And I phoned her. And and she was ecstatic. But the person who was most ecstatic about it is my uncle Antoine, who... how do I express how much of a Beatles fan he is? He's blind, and he's been blind since birth, and he can play and sing every single... He's a really good musician, play and sing every single Beatles song that exists. And we tested him on this at a wedding that we were at, me and Lottie, and we were with loads of people, and he just sat on a piano, and we were there. It was my aunt's, his sister's place, and we were there for about 9 or 10 days. And every day he'd get up, and every day he'd play a different Beatles album or play it, not play it on the record, but like play and sing all of it with all the harmonies. And he'd sing and everyone would sing along and he'd know all the weird verses. He'd know the B-sides, everything, every single thing. And I phoned him up to tell him and he was more excited about it than anyone. I just played with Paul McCartney. Antoine, I've just played with Paul McCartney. Really? Wow, that's amazing, Al. Wow, it's so good. Like, beautiful experience.
Amazing. And when you were playing, like, were you... Did you become more conscious about what you were playing because you were thinking, I can't fuck this up?
No. It was joy. It was pure. It was the epitome of, like, this is what music is for. Everyone smiling. Everyone having a good time. That was it. It was the purity of it. And he sung like a boy. He sung like a kid doing it for the first time. You know that thing where, you know, the creative process is strongest in children, and like because they haven't become self-conscious and self-aware, and like they haven't kind of started to edit themselves in the same way that adult, you know, that fear, read the Inner Game of Music. It talks all about that stuff, you know, conquering the fear. But like he played like that. He played like he had nothing to lose. He played like he had nothing to gain. He was doing it because he loved it. Stevie Wonder does the same, you know, that joy of like, and I basked in it for, it stayed with me, it's still with me, you know. Even though I've forgotten the songs I played, I still remember the feeling. Mm. Remember them, getting shivers just thinking about that, you know, that time. Such a brilliant experience. Yeah, so brilliant.
Picasso once said, we are all born artists, but we have to... The biggest challenge is to remain an artist as we grow older.
Right.
And I guess it's that kind of like excitement and joy at the young age that's... And it's great that he was embodying that then and not just going, oh, I've got to play these bloody songs I've played 1,000 times
Well,
before.
He didn't have to play them. I mean, that was the thing. It was his own party that he'd thrown for his... I think it was for his publishing company. And he was there anyway. And he was just like... Just wanted to get involved.
Did you know he was going to be involved? So was like, was it a case that you thought,
we'd
better learn some songs? Oh, okay.
No idea. I mean, we knew he was going to be there, and obviously, he's known for it. He's known for getting up at those kind of things.
So there's always that.
There was the hope, constant hope of like, we really, really want to play with Paul McCartney. But when it happens, you know, I've been starstruck very few times in my life. Like, I don't really understand people feigning to fame. I do understand it, but I don't have it. I don't really get that kind of like groveling, we are not worthy feeling.
Yeah.
Apart from a couple of times, and he was the biggest one. I was just like, him and Taylor Hawkins was the other one.
Taylor Hawkins. Yeah,
weirdly, I don't know why I kind of got starstruck with Taylor Hawkins. But anyway, it was Paul McCartney all the way. It was like, wow, this is a real moment, and I clammed up. But playing was wonderful.
You played well. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
So we talked about your journey with the drum kit and your relationship with the drum kit. What's the longest you've gone without playing the drums and why?
Since I became a professional.
Yeah. What's the longest period you've gone without playing drums?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't really put a time on it, but probably, I mean, when, you know, when real serious family stuff happens.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of thing. That's pretty...
But there hasn't been a period that you kind of fell out of love with the drums?
Never,
that
no.
You chose to?
You know, you haven't... Yeah, I always have a... You always kind of have a relationship with your instrument, and sometimes it's not always love. Sometimes there's a kind of prison aspect to it. Like, you're stuck in a... You're stuck because... You have to be able to play well for the call you don't know that you're going to get, you know. So you're kind of practicing, and I did it for a long time. You're kind of practicing for something that you don't know what it is, when's it coming, you know. There's that whole like psychological aspect of learning your craft when you haven't necessarily got an outlet for it at that particular time, and that can be really tough. So I loved practicing for a long, long time. And then when I didn't have any gigs and when I wasn't really playing out that much, you kind of, because you're not playing out, you kind of have got to practice more. You kind of got to sit behind the kit and work on it. And then when it's like, what's it for? 2 months later, you still haven't got a gig that is of any note. Why are we here? Like, why am I sitting behind this practice? And you start questioning yourself, and then it's suddenly like you feel like you're stuck with it.
Mm. Interesting stuff. Thank you for answering that so honestly. If you could...
I'm all about honesty. I literally, you asked me a question and I probably couldn't lie to you.
That's good. That's a good quality to have. If you could go in a time machine and go back to one gig you've played to be in the audience for, what would it be?
I don't think I'd ever be so... I don't listen to myself particularly. I don't Google myself. Well, I don't anymore. You know, when I wanted my website to have like more hits and stuff, I was Googling myself to see if it came first. but I don't know if I'd go and watch myself at a gig.
Is there one particularly you'd like to be in the audience for? It might not have been for you, but there was a gig that you played. I'd love to be in the audience for that. So a friend of mine I mentioned before, and like Johnny's in a band called 1975, and they're playing massive shows at the moment. Yeah, they play the O2 on Saturday. We had a drink afterwards, and I was just like, you know. Yes, everybody in that room potentially is like envious of the fact that you're in that position, but actually you will never get to see a 1975 play such a live great show. And they've got I don't know if you remember, the Gorillaz had like these amazing visuals and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're using
the
same person.
All the musicians were behind the screen, weren't they?
Like, so the person who created all of that is now the 1975. So the live show is fucking, whether you like music or not, the live show is fucking amazing. And like I was saying to John afterwards, I was like you're missing out on this great performance, if you like. So is there a kind of a gig or a tour that you think I'd love to be in the audience?
Do you know what? For me, it's always first times or improvisational stuff where you're surprised by what's going to be happening. I always love, and I don't always get to do it, but I do love the kind of unpredictability of an improvised show. I must say, some of the kind of smallest shows I've ever done for like a few people where I've had a feeling have stuck with me. I used to play this residency in Cambridge where I lived for a long time. I didn't go to university there because I'm nowhere near clever enough.
Display our intelligences in different ways. We're all the same intelligence, and yours is behind a drum kit.
So well, thank you for saying so. But I don't think that would get me into Cambridge Uni. My 5A stars behind the snare drum is probably the most. Some of the most fun I've ever had was playing at this little bar in Cambridge. I had his residency for years and years and years, with two or three bands there. One of them was with, well, some really great musicians. There's some brilliant, Chris Hill, who I mentioned earlier on, a bass player, who's now, I mean, he plays bass very well. He was touring with big people for a long time, and now he writes a lot. You'll hear him on adverts and like big pieces of music and stuff. But he's one of those bass players that just has it. There's also another bass player called Johnny Briley, who just has it. He's playing with a band called Fafula now, with Dave Smith playing drums. He plays for other people, but he's absolute badass, like properly brilliant musical brain. I had a feeling playing with him and a guy called John Turville, who is a piano player, and again, genius, brilliant guys, who were all in Cambridge at that time, in this little residency gig where we were playing stuff, and I just floated above the drums. I remember sitting there looking down at the experience going, this is why, how, I don't understand how this is happening. Wow. One of the first times it had happened. Kind of out of body, it was literally out of body for me. And it was so exciting playing stuff which was had a kind of vague remit. Oh no, remit's the wrong word. Like a arrangement of a song. So you're playing the song, but you're kind of doing a version that's just happening at that moment and will never happen again. It's never happened before. That combination of things is gone after that moment. I'd love to have seen, I kind of did see it because I was having an out-of-body experience. I was floating above myself and like, what is going on? And I tried since those experiences, I had loads of them with those musicians, Sam Grimley, Sarah Mitra, my friend Booger, who played with Ezio, who still does, Louis Thorne. There's some, you know, brilliant kind of players around that scene that I was playing in at the time. Just remarkable. I got introduced to loads of players, especially bass players. Rob Malarkey, I met him at that residency. Natalie Williams, a singer, met her, played with them for years afterwards. Andy Hamill, the bass player, like pretty like special, unique players on their instruments. And in fact, just their chosen instruments, whatever they played, they'd have that voice. And all wonderful, always different, always interesting, and always a lesson. Those kind of things I'd love to see again, even though it was just a bunch of piss people in a bar.
What ambitions do you have left?
None. Oh, you know, like, my ambitions are probably more friendship, lifestyle, family-based things than they are with music and drums. I kind of think, you know, if I wrote a letter with listing the stuff that I do now and that I've done in the past to my like 18-year-old self, my 18-year-old self would be like, tick, done. Okay, right, you're going to have done it by the time you're 40. Like, this is, you know, all I care about is the feeling I get from playing in terms of my job anyway. Mm. And the feeling is based around people playing and being with good people and having a nice life. I say nice life. Obviously, great music comes out of war and, you know, malaise and bad tough times for people a lot. You know, sometimes you need to go through those things. But my ambitions are just to stay. Like, what's the music industry going to be doing in 20 years? I don't know. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to lift a drum kit into a car in 20 years, 30 years maybe. So stay healthy. My ambition is to stay healthy and for people around me to stay healthy. And that's kind of it. I don't really think about, you know, I'd love to play with these people because I would. And I'd love to play with these people, and, you know, list them. But I'm playing with wonderful people.
Yeah, I mean, there's ones we've not even dived into. So, like, you've recorded on, like, Justin Timberlake records. You've got the One Direction thing behind you as well. So you played on, like, some massive, massive records. Last question, then. What one should I go for?
Ask them both.
What's the most important piece of music, either memorabilia or thing, that you have that if the house was burning down, your family were completely safe, that you'd want to pick up that means something to you?
I can't answer that. Don't know. Nothing. The family, the people, everything else is just a tool. If it's something, a piece of artwork that I've received, then maybe, but you know, you can buy a record again. I have drums which are irreplaceable, but you know, seriously, it's just a drum, and I could always express myself on another drum. So I don't think there's anything specific.
Okay, last question. This is one we asked to all guests on the podcast, on the Stage Left podcast.
Hourly rate.
What fears do you have for the music industry, if any, and how might you address those fears, or how might those fears be addressed?
Well, I actually think I don't know about industry, but music, it's a golden time. There's some incredible people making incredible music and talking about important stuff. Even watching the Brits the other day, having watched the first Brits in my life, like
Dave's performance on there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like stuff like that, where people are really talking about stuff that matters. Cool. And I had a discussion with someone a little while ago about there's no protest music anymore. I wholeheartedly disagreed with him. And I think that protest music is just, it's not all we are saying is give peace a chance anymore. It's much deeper.
It's complex.
It really is. And people talk about what's near them. People in art, in all art, express what's happening, hopefully. And at the moment in music, it's happening. Like, people are expressing themselves better than ever. Well, don't know about that. Maybe not better than ever, but as well as has ever happened. People can make music in their bedrooms. You know, people can buy stuff. they can make a record on 250 quid if they really, really try. Microphone, a little keyboard, not even that, and a laptop. Second-hand laptop, you know. I think it's a golden time. I think it's a wonderful place to be in the world when music is consistently so good. I know a lot of people saying, music is terrible nowadays. No, it's amazing. It's incredible. Everyone can make it. And the cream is now, like, people who are really good are now, everyone can make music. So everything got pretty good. And now, 5-10 years later, everything, the great stuff is out there. The people are hearing wonderful music. So my fears are that I haven't got fears, but I hope that this will continue like this. I hope that those people will be able to make a living, and it won't go to the, the money that they make from their creativity, and that they need to pay the rent, and they need to, like, pay the bills and stuff, and just live and make the next record goes to them, rather than some executive or someone in an office who I don't doubt do work very hard and need to be there in order to make everything work. But the artists need to survive. They always have. I have no fears, but I do have a lot of hope.
Great. And just finally tell us, like, what's next. So you obviously, this is your studio, so people can, like, hire you to, like, play on their records.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That is so fucking cool. Right?
Yeah.
Next record, I'm calling you up. Right?
Great, that's great, amazing. Great.
So, and you do remote stuff and you do recording. Do you do recording bands in here and stuff?
I never
like
record
that?
Bands.
So it's just yourself.
It's just drums. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got other stuff in here that just in case, but. I record drums and percussion and rhythmy stuff, whatever's needed. I'll program things and, like, you know, I'll mix drums and whatever, just whatever's needed. You know, yeah. I kind of develop my skills through for the job rather than I had a skill and came into the job.
Nice.
With my drums here, you know, it's a place that I can come to. I cycle down from my house. I arrive after dropping my son off at nursery, and I can pick up the sticks and press record, and immediately within 20 minutes I can have a take.
Great. Done,
which is I know a lot of drummers, and in fact all musical instruments, but drums is the tough one because you need a space and you need microphones, you need more stuff, you need more gear, and a lot of people are doing it, and all best of luck for everyone, because it's like a, you know, it's something that I really love. I really enjoy it.
And you're then going on tour with Elbow for the next couple of months as well, is that right?
Yeah, UK? I've actually got quite a bit of studio stuff before then. We rehearse in mid March, and up until then I've got quite a few albums, most of them in here, a few in other studios here and there in London, and then we've got 5 weeks on the road, so it's all UK apart from a couple of bits. We're in Amsterdam and Dublin, and then we go up to Belfast.
Good choices.
Yeah. Yeah, party towns. Yeah. Dublin, what a music town, mate. Yeah. One of the best, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then up to Belfast and then back into the UK and all around. We've got three or four at the Hammersmith Apollo and three or four in Manchester Apollo. Mm. And
all across the UK.
All across the UK. So, yeah, come on, check it out. And then after that, I've got another couple of albums, which is great, back in completely unrelated to Elbow. And then we're doing Australia, New Zealand, and then after that, a few bits in the summer, and then, yeah, probably finished with that album now after that.
Yeah.
And then on to, don't know, what's happening after that? June, I'm unemployed, so give me a call. I'd love to do your album.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, thank you for your wisdom, your insight. You know, as you say, like, you've cracked it. You've kind of, like, ticked all those things that, you know, you would have loved to have done when you were 18. You know, you've left that footprint on the music industry by playing on songs that will be listened to for many, many decades to come. So good luck with all the stuff coming up. Good luck on the upcoming tour. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Deck podcast.
Thank you so much, Chris. Much appreciated. I love being here.